good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show continues. Chef is finding out that even some of his loyal acolytes in his home district are not happy with him. He had a town hall meeting where he got shouted down. So he may find himself answering to the voters for putting what he wants ahead of what they want. Well, we've been talking about mysterious disappearances of individuals and airplanes, but how about kingdoms? Yes, since ancient times, men have talked about lost cities and vanished civilizations, glittering kingdoms far beyond the horizon with forgotten secrets and unbelievable treasures waiting for the individual to take them. But for all the mystical allure of these fabled lands, even more alluring than El Dorado is the story of Atlantis, legendary island kingdom in the Atlantic. According to ancient and medieval accounts, sank in a cataclysmic upheaval about 12,000 years ago, never to rise again. Interestingly enough, 12,000 years ago is about the same time that most of the legends date the flood of the Bible. So what happened to this island kingdom? Assuming the old legends are true about the kingdom's existence, how did it suddenly vanish at the apex of its glory, leaving future generations to ponder its mystical disappearance? That exact location of Atlantis has been lost in the mists of time. Greek philosopher Plato put it in the great ocean, the western sea whose swelling waves rose beyond the pillars of Hercules, the watery realm today known as the Straits of Gibraltar. Now, those who sought this lost paradise have tried to find it in a number of places: Tibet, the Andes, Australia, the Caucasus, South Africa, the Amazon Basin, Libya, Cuba, Florida, the Caribbean, the Basque Country of Spain, India, Morocco, Egypt, Mexico, Ceylon, China, the North Sea, Russia, Indonesia, even the Gobi Desert. Well, it seemed that a continent like Atlantis, larger than Europe, with cities and advanced technology and an enlightened utopian government, would have left behind some kind of clue to its very existence. Most of what's known about this ancient kingdom comes from two of Plato's dialogues, Timaeus and Critias. Written around 370 BC, the dialogue is supposedly based on information handed down from 200-year-old records of the Greek ruler Solon, who had heard of Atlantis from an earlier Egyptian priest. Now, Plato described Atlantis as a wonderful empire that had apparently conquered vast regions of the world, including Egypt. When an attack against Greece failed, though, Atlantis ran into a bit of trouble. According to Plato, there occurred violent earthquakes and floods, and in a single day and night of misfortune, all the warlike men in a body sank into the earth, and the island of Atlantis vanished to the depths of the sea. According to this little story, that ended the days of Atlantis. A sophisticated society that had defied the will of Zeus and thus was destroyed. Well, the philosopher's story of sunken continent captivated generations. Some Greek thinkers, Aristotle and Plato primarily, disputed the existence of Atlantis. Plutarch and Herodotus wrote of it as historical fact. Atlantis, the antediluvian world, became entrenched in folklore all around the world, appeared on ocean maps, and it was sought relentlessly by explorers down through the ages. Well, During the Middle Ages, as wars and plagues and famine ravaged Europe, the story of Atlantis was all but forgotten, except by very few. It wasn't until the 15th century the legend was rediscovered thanks to explorers and cartographers who included the Forgotten Empire on their maps. When America was discovered, it was frequently identified with Atlantis, even though dry land obviously conflicted with the legend of a sunken continent. And many continued to believe, though, that the mountain peaks of the Azores, the Cape Verde Islands, the Canaries, and even Madeira were the true visible remains of the Lost Kingdom. All the champions of the Atlantis story in the modern era, none defended it more vigorously or more passionately than a businessman turned politician from Philadelphia, Ignatius Loyola Donnelly. 1882, more than 2,300 years after Plato first wrote about Atlantis, Donnelly published a book entitled Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. It was an instant international bestseller that followers viewed as the Bible of Atlantology, if that's a word. According to Donnelly, Atlantis was the world that preceded the great flood of the Bible. He described the people of Atlantis as handsome, prosperous, technically advanced sun worshippers. Their oldest colony was Egypt, whose civilization reproduced that of the Mother Kingdom. It is interesting to note that even the most skeptical archaeologist will agree that the civilization of Egypt appeared at its peak and descended from that. Borrowing heavily from contemporary science and constructing his theory, Donnelly spoke of the Atlantean kingdom as the original Garden of Eden, the Elysian fields, the home of powerful kings and queens who were later to become the gods and goddesses of the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Phoenicians, the Hindus, the Scandinavians, and the prehistoric inhabitants of North, Central, and South America. Atlantis was also said to be the original home of the Basque of Spain, Portugal, and southern France. Now, this unusual group of people is racially and linguistically different from other Europeans. Atlantis was also said to be the ancestral homeland of the scattered tribes of white Indians who were occasionally seen in places like Venezuela and Peru. Pale-skinned pre-Columbian gods of the New World might also have been Atlanteans, as were the Conches, cave-dwelling Aborigines of the Canary Islands who were wiped out by the Spanish. The height of its glory, Atlantis was a fair and wondrous land, according to ancient descriptions, with magnificent mountain ranges, lush plains, and a variety of exotic animal life, including elephants that, according to some accounts, were trained to fly. If an elephant flew over, I'd hate to see what kind of deposit it'd leave behind. The capital, built at the very center of the island, was remarkable for its canals and tree-lined boulevards, as well as for the scale and splendor of its buildings and grand statues, it's said to be made of gold. Then came that terrible day 12,000 years ago when the entire island, along with most of its inhabitants, were destroyed by a series of earthquakes and tidal waves that shook the once mighty kingdom to pieces. When Atlantis perished in that terrible convulsion of nature, few citizens escaped in ships and rafts bearing the dreadful news to the nations of both East and West. But it's said to be from this beginning that the stories of the Great Flood began that had been told all over the world. As Donnelly saw it, these Atlantean refugees planted the seeds for the creation of many new civilizations, India, Cambodia, the Americas, as well as Egypt, Phoenicia, Mesopotamia, and elsewhere. Donnelly had been drawn into the Atlantis story while serving as a U.S. congressman. If Congress was as exciting then as it is now, that would explain why he spent countless hours in the Library of Congress poring over the latest books and scientific journals that dealt with geology, history, folklore, world literature, religion, mythology, and linguistics. And as his interest in the topics grew, so did his obsession. He felt Atlantis had to exist. How else to explain the many similarities between the old and new worlds? Botanical, biological, architectural, and cultural. And why, he wondered, did so many American and European animals and plants look alike? Why the coincidence of pyramids and pillars and burial mounds and artistic works and similarly designed ships appearing on both sides of the Atlantic. Donnelly's answer was that everything had originated in the drowned continent of Atlantis, the terrestrial paradise, the Isle of the Blessed, the Pure Land, the original Garden of Eden, and then spread to the rest of the world by survivors who escaped the disaster in great ships, carrying with them not only dreaded memories of that day, but also the seeds and skills of which to recreate their old world someplace else. He wrote, "I can't believe the great inventions were duplicated spontaneously in different countries. If this were so, all savages would have invented the boomerang. All savages would have possessed pottery, bows and arrows, slings, tents, canoes. In short," he said, "all races would have risen to civilization. For certainly the comforts of life are as agreeable to one people as to another." But to prove his theory once and for all, Donnelly knew what he needed. A single engraved tablet dredged up from Plato's island would be worth more to science and strike the imagination of mankind than all the gold of Peru, all the monuments of Egypt, and all the terracotta fragments gathered from the great libraries of Chaldea. But so far, the ocean has yielded no such tablet. 12,000 years after its dramatic and enigmatic disappearance, the doomed continent of Atlantis is still nothing more than a glorious myth. Now, there have been quite a number of finds that many have pointed to as proof of the existence of Atlantis. I've got a book that I did. It's called Mystery Men, and it's about the mysterious teachers who appeared out of nowhere to teach the basics of civilization. And those who came to Peru and to Mexico told their followers that they came from an island to the east that sank into the sea. Well, that pretty much is the description of the fabled Atlantis. Well, we'll talk more about Atlantis as time goes on, of course. Right now, we're going to talk about an individual whose name has echoed down through the halls of history, named Ambrose Bierce. There's a good chance that this eccentric and popular writer of the weird got his wish. That, because he had claimed that if you hear of my being stood up against a Mexican stone wall and shot, please know I think that's a pretty good way to depart life. Beats old age, disease, or falling down the cellar stairs. See, he lived at a time when the Civil War was over, the Mexican Revolution, their internal revolution was going on. And he went to Mexico. Now, some say the counter-revolutionary soldiers under dictator Victoriano Huerta captured Bierce and machine-gunned him for his anti-government activities. One newspaper claimed he vanished in the mountains of Peru looking for a lost city of gold, and another say he died as a result of a Mayan curse because he stole an ancient crystal skull. Now, the crystal skulls did exist. I've seen them. I've touched them. But are they capable of placing a curse on somebody? Haven't seen any evidence of that yet. Fact is, nobody really knows what happened to Ambrose Gwinnett Bierce. He was a writer often hailed as the most prolific and colorful journalist in American history. He wrote a lot of weird fiction. And to date, his fate remains as strange and mysterious as many of the darkly daring articles he wrote in a career spanning more than 40 years. What is known is that early one morning in the autumn of 1913, at the reasonably ripe age of 71, this ex-Civil War officer and retired journalist got out of his bed, saddled up the family horse, and rode away from his home near Washington, D.C., he headed south to start with, first stopping off at famous Civil War battlefields in Tennessee, Georgia, and Mississippi, before passing through Louisiana and Texas on his way to the Badlands of war-torn Mexico. far as anybody was able to determine, his goal was to join up with a gang of revolutionaries led by Generalissimo Francisco Pancho Villa. But somewhere along the way, this aged would-be soldier fortune vanished, as if he never was. Never seen or heard from again, despite countless bogus claims and dozens of official and unofficial search efforts. More than 100 years later, people the world over are still intrigued by the mysterious circumstances surrounding the disappearance of Bierce. He was known as one of America's foremost teller of tall tales. Now, his strange destiny remains one of the literary world's most enduring and fascinating mysteries. So many theories have popped up over the years to account for his disappearance. It'd probably fill the small library all by themselves. For years, newspaper reporters, detectives, and Secret Service agents from the U.S. combed the rugged hinterlands of Mexico and Latin America for clues to the missing writer's whereabouts. But not a trace of this elderly man was ever found, leading one biographer to conclude that Bierce had simply but stylishly vanished from the face of the earth. Whatever happened, it's highly unlikely that Bierce would have been flattered by all the hoopla surrounding his curious escaping act. But interest in whatever happened to him soon reached international levels, eclipsing that of his books and columns. He was the author of The Devil's Dictionary, In the Midst of Life, Fantastic Fables, and Can Such Things Be? As Clifton Fetterman, the noted essayist, once remarked, Bierce was never a great writer. He has painful faults of vulgarity and cheapness of imagination, but his style, for one thing, will preserve him, and the purity of his misanthropy as well. They'll all help keep him alive in the minds of people. Gloomy, morose, sarcastic, bitter. These words have all been used to describe the man whom critics and colleagues alike once dubbed Bitter Bierce, because of his fierce, uncompromised literary assaults on what he considered a depraved, morally bankrupt society. He attacked hypocrisy, especially wherever he found it, from the halls of Congress to the sanctuaries of church and cathedrals everywhere. He railed against big business and the military, preferring to champion the causes of the poor and the downtrodden. In his day, Bierce was regarded as a minor prophet of hopelessness, a cynical, pessimistic fellow whose impassioned pen unleashed a flood of temperamental tirades against government, Wall Street, religion, and even progress, that he referred to as that old devil. Born in a log cabin in Meigs County, Ohio, on June 24, 1842, he was the 10th of 13 children, all of whom had names beginning with the first letter of the alphabet. His brothers and sisters were Abigail, Amelia, Ann, Addison, Aurelius, Augustus, Almeida, Andrew, Albert, Arthur, Aelia, and Aurelia. Enrolled in a Kentucky military institute at the age of 17, but for some reason failed to complete his studies. Something that many said troubled him for the rest of his life. When the Civil War broke out in 1861, he enlisted in the Union Army, fought at Shiloh, Chickamauga, Lookout Mountain, Missionary Ridge, and a number of other battlefields. That infuriated and inspired him. He served with General Sherman's band of blue-coated marauders as they marched and fought their way through Georgia to Savannah and on into the Carolinas. Throughout the war, he was a member of the 9th Indiana Infantry Regiment, rising through the ranks to become an officer. Although on the side of the North, he shared sympathies with the aristocratic planter culture of the antebellum South. Ironically, he held abolitionist views and wrote bristling columns for anti-slavery newspapers in Indiana. His experiences in combat greatly influenced his outlook on life and gave shape to his curious writing style. Several of his most popular short stories, including an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, were centered around wartime characters and themes. After the war, Bierce settled in San Francisco, where he found a job with a newsletter, which he eventually became editor. While not interviewing veterans and writing about wartime experiences, he sought out unusual and colorful characters to cover, including sailors on the waterfront, criminals, and prostitutes. Described as a tall, handsome man with a fair complexion, blue eyes, and a thick mustache, he attracted women wherever he went. In 1871, he settled down, got married, and had three children. It was at this time that the stinging nature of his work emerged, and he got the nickname Bitter Bierce. Due to a lifelong asthma problem, he remained in San Francisco from 1876 to 1976. Excuse me. 1876 to 1896, duh. Attracting a large fan base with his daily column in the San Francisco Examiner. His fiction that was riddled with tales of death and a supernatural had a particular appeal to his legions of readers. Other writers idolized him, including two who met tragic ends. George Serling, who committed suicide, and Herman Schoeffer, who killed his wife before shooting himself. The death of Bierce's friends only deepened his charismatic reputation and dark allure. A lot of people seem to think he hung the moon. Some biographers have pointed out that Bierce's attraction to death made him superstitious. He avoided cemeteries whenever possible, kept a fire going in the hearth all night, and generally preferred not to be alone. After the death of his wife Molly and his two sons, Day and Leigh, Bierce forbade the placement of tombstones on their graves. His reputation as a hard-hitting, crusading journalist with a dark side continued to grow when he moved to New York and took on writing assignments with the New York Journal and the New York American. He wasn't happy in New York, though, and he returned to California to accept the job with the San Francisco Chronicle. Continued to freelance for a number of national publications, including Cosmopolitan, where became a household name, penning dark and disturbing stories about death and mystery and the supernatural. Bierce was never a happy man. Dead ends, failures, and tragedies haunted his personal life. 1889, his son was killed in a low-rent shooting brawl over a girl. 2 years later, his second wife left him, finally divorced him in 1904. In 1901, his youngest son died of alcoholism. And in 1913, Bierce, old, asthmatic, weary, his creative power only in the acrid memory, made his queer escape from civilization, presumably into Mexico, where he met whatever his fate was to be. After his whirlwind tour of Civil War battlefields in 1913, he told friends about his plans to slip away to Mexico and South America. Strange countries in which things happen, he said. And this would be his final excursion. He said he would go through Mexico to one of the Pacific ports and then sail to South America. And from there, he had traveled across the Andes, maybe even the entire continent. Told his friends not to expect to ever see him again. And they didn't. When at the time, Mexico was in the midst of one of its many revolutionary disruptions. And Bierce expressed concern in some of his letters being sent back home. He'd eventually be shot by one of Pancho Villa's men. He even referred to his trip as Jornada de Muerte, Journey of Death. From El Paso, Texas, Bierce crossed the Mexican border into Juarez. And amazingly, he did not encounter Pancho Villa, who had recently passed through the region in person, having liberated it from the country's notorious dictator, Huerta. Some of his Revolutionary Guards did, however, provide Bierce with credentials that allowed him to travel with elements of Villa's army on horseback. December 26, 1913, he wrote a letter to his friend, Blance Partington, from Chihuahua, Mexico, and he said, "As for me, I'll leave here tomorrow for an unknown destination." And that was the last communication anybody had with the mysterious Ambrose Bierce. Now, theories surrounding his disappearance started circulating immediately. One popular notion was he died during the siege of Orinaga on January 11, 1914. A dispatch reported by the Mexican army mentioned the casualty as Bierce. It's a short step to Ambrose Bierce. Another theory was that Pancho Villa ordered the old man's execution after arguing with him about military strategy. Third story that surfaced in several American newspapers claimed he was shot by Villa's right-hand man, General Tomas Urbina, after being arrested in a gun-running operation. Well, another questionable story put Bierce at the head of a ring of spies trying to trace the movements of possible enemies in the Panama Canal area. And even stranger tales about the writer's disappearance hit the news. The weirdest account of his death reads like an Indiana Jones mystery, claiming that Bierce and an American companion stole a Mayan artifact, the Skull of Doom, as it was called, but died in an attempt to return to the U.S. with their legendary treasure. One final story claimed that Bierce, now old and weakened by the hardships of revolutionary Mexico, simply collapsed under the strain of battle and died of exposure in a Mexican desert surrounded by beautiful young virgins. None of the claims were, of course, ever validated. As years passed without any real closure, even wilder accounts of his vanishing and eventual death surfaced. One El Paso citizen claimed that Bierce was either poisoned or had poisoned himself and was buried in a local backyard. Friends of Bierce in Washington claimed he'd gone to the Grand Canyon and jumped to his death or blew his brains out with a revolver. The most incredible theory was that Bierce had wandered away from Villa's army and got lost in a southern desert. He was then captured by natives who supposedly boiled him alive, shrunk his remains, wrapped him in the skin of a jaguar, and worshipped it as the relic of a god. Though never great, his writings were widely read in America. In Europe, though, his works were especially popular, especially in France and Germany. And after his strange disappearance made international headlines, his popularity soared even higher. His stories, assembled in book-length collections, ranged from the supernatural and horror to the grotesquely humorous, seeking to capitalize on a resurging interest in the Bierce phenomenon in the early 1990s, Hollywood released a $25 million feature film called The Old Gringo, starring Gregory Peck, based on the life of the reclusive, controversial writer. Well, I don't know if he was being if he was predicting it or planning for it, but Bierce once wrote, "Nobody will find my bones." And little did he know how prophetic those words would be when at the age of 71 he took off from Mexico, ostensibly to observe the revolution and rocking the Latin American nation. He told a reporter, "I'm on my way to Mexico. I like the fighting. I want to see it and maybe be involved in it." As the years passed and people on both sides of the Rio Grande continued to speculate on his mysterious fate, some wondered if he had in fact committed suicide, as so many alleged, or was it natural causes, such as the asthma that had plagued him all his life. Of course, the most favorite theory was that it was shot by Mexican soldiers or revolutionary rebels under Pancho Villa. But some say he didn't die in Mexico at all, that he made his way to England or went back to his old home in San Francisco. One writer even theorized he spent his last years in an asylum for the insane in California. Whatever may be the truth of the matter, Ambrose Bierce's curious ending remains as mystifying today as it was during his last years. Now, there have been a lot of unusual disappearances over the years. Ambrose Bierce, that name probably pops up many times if you ask the average individual about unexplained disappearances. But another one, who may not be as well known, but certainly was as mystifying, was the fate of Theodosia Burr Austin, the daughter of Aaron Burr, former Vice President of the United States. Now, the story begins one cold winter's morning in 1813. Residents of Nag's Head, a tiny coastal community in North Carolina, woke up to an astonishing sight. At the beach, bobbing in the surf, was a large, handsomely appointed schooner that apparently washed ashore during the night. There was no one on board. It took a little while for investigators to get themselves on board, but except for a scrawny black kitten in the kitchen, the ship was completely deserted. Apparently, this vessel had been abandoned offshore, but what was the most interesting thing was that no lifeboats were missing. And except for minor damage to the keel, the ship appeared to be in excellent condition. All the sails were still set, the rudder was lashed, the craft seemed to be in good order, but it was entirely deserted except for the kitten. In one of the cabins were fancy silk dresses, a vase of beautiful flowers, and a portrait of a lovely young woman in white. Well, determined to get to the bottom of the mystery, investigators launched a cabin-to-cabin search for clues. They found nothing. No note, no log, no record that might explain the identity of either the schooner or the whereabouts of its missing passengers and crew. It was as if everyone on board the ship had just simply vanished. In those days, it wasn't all that unusual for a ship to wash up on shore deserted, nor was it strange for sailing vessels to come across abandoned ships at sea. That's because pirates on the prowl for booty constantly menace seafaring traffic, searching for easy prey. After capturing an unfortunate vessel, the common practice was to make the passengers and crew walk the plank. In some cases, they'd keep any females on board for themselves or sell them into slavery. A few weeks before the Nag's Head discovery, the New York-bound schooner named the Patriot had disappeared shortly after sailing from Georgetown, South Carolina. No trace of the Patriot, a former New York pilot boat and converted privateer, had ever been found, in spite of one of the largest searches and rescue operations in American history at the time. So could the schooner that drifted ashore at Nag Heads be the missing Patriot? Well, in spite of what you might think, no officials from New York came down to North Carolina to investigate, and with the war with England going on, War of 1812, don't you know, fearful Carolinians had other things on their minds besides trying to determine the identity of a shipwreck. So the mysterious schooner on the beach was soon forgotten. Or more than 200 years later, the strange disappearance of the Patriot and the circumstances surrounding the enigmatic shipwrecked schooner on the North Carolina coast remain one of maritime history's greatest unsolved mysteries. Many theories have come and gone, but so far no one has been able to answer two very crucial questions. Was the wrecked vessel actually the Patriot? And if it was, what happened to the passengers and crew? Well, maybe the incident wouldn't have aroused such intense national and international interest had it not been for the fact that one of the passengers on board the Patriot, Theodosia Burr Austin, was the wife of Joseph Austin, newly elected governor of South Carolina. She was also the daughter of Aaron Burr, controversial former vice president of the U.S., now regarded by many as the most hated man in America. Not only had Burr killed former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton in a gun duel a few years earlier in 1804, he'd recently returned from exile in Europe after having been acquitted of other charges to include treason. Well, Theodosia Bartow Burr, to give her her maiden name, was born June 21, 1783 in Albany, New York. The future First Lady of South Carolina grew up in a rarefied world of wealth, power, and fame. Her mother, also named Theodosia, was a cultured, brilliant woman, the mother of five. After the death of her first husband, though, she scandalized New York society when she announced she was marrying an equally brilliant but much younger blue-blooded lawyer and Revolutionary War soldier named Aaron Burr. Well, Theodosia, the only child of the couple to survive, became the center of her parents' attention, particularly her father's. Aaron Burr was a handsome, slender man with gray eyes, receding hairline. Saw to it that Theo, as he called her, enjoyed the best education money could buy. From music and dance and arithmetic to Latin, French, Greek, and English composition. Theodosia's mother died when she was 11, leaving her alone in a protective care of her father. Aaron Burr saw to it that the girl continued to enjoy a high standard of living. Well, in 1800, Theodosia became enamored with Joseph Alton, a wealthy planter from South Carolina. She was 17 at the time. Having suffered economic losses and several failed business ventures, Aaron Burr encouraged his daughter's relationship with Alston, suspecting a marriage between the two might be the answer to his financial woes. The wedding went forward in grand style, with parties lasting for weeks. The couple could have honeymooned anywhere in the world, but chose to celebrate their vows at Niagara Falls, the first recorded couple to do so at the famous falls on the border of the United States and Canada. The war with England resulted in long periods of separation for the newlyweds. Absence of her husband, Theodosia doted on the couple's only child, Aaron Burr Alston, who soon became the center of her world. But the child's birth had taken a toll on her already fragile health. Looking for medical relief, she frequently visited spas at Saratoga Springs and elsewhere in New England and along the eastern seaboard. Well, in June of 1812, her emotional and physical distress intensified when her son died of malaria at the age of 10. Meanwhile, Aaron Burr, along with a trio of other mercenaries, had been forced to flee the U.S. after he found guilty of hatching a bizarre scheme in 1807 to separate part of the old American Southwest from the rest of the nation. Now, no one's ever sure what the group intended to do, but Burr apparently had in mind making himself emperor or king of this new republic. He was accused of treason, but was later acquitted. While her father remained in exile, Theodosia, acting as his agent, raised money, which she sent to him and also sent him messages. She lobbied Secretary of Treasury Albert Gallatin and First Lady Dolly Madison for their support in getting a smooth return for her father. Not long after her son's funeral, Theodosia decided to risk sailing past the British Brocklade to visit her father, who'd recently returned from Europe to New York. Her husband's duties as governor of the rebellious colony in South Carolina, plus his role as head of the state militia, meant he'd have to let his wife go by herself. Frail, sickly, and depressed over the loss of their only child, Theodosia booked passage on the Patriot. On the morning of December 30th, 1812, accompanied by personal friend and physician Timothy Green, the 29-year-old woman climbed aboard the vessel and settled down for the long, dangerous journey north. Now, the Patriot was noted as a fast schooner, and as the ship sailed away, Theodosia braced herself against the stormy winter cold of the Atlantic. Well, she undoubtedly had more things on her mind that morning than her deteriorating health, the recent loss of her child, or running in the British man of war. The shame of her father's treasonous actions continued to haunt her, even though she'd gone to great lengths to help win his freedom. She was proud of his accomplishments, and as many said, everyone makes a slip every now and then. A graduate of the College of New Jersey, now Princeton, Burr rose through the fledgling political system to become a successful U.S. senator from New York. In 1800, after a controversial presidential campaign in which he and Thomas Jefferson got the same number of votes, the House of Representatives, under the pressure from Alexander Hamilton, gave the presidency to Jefferson and the vice presidency to Burr. Well, even though Burr feuded with the controversial Virginian, he was a loyal subordinate and helped Jefferson gain passage of several important legislative bills, including authorization for the famed Lewis and Clark expedition. It helped pave the way for the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of the U.S. Well, the voyage to New York was anything but comfortable for Theodosia. Heavy seas tossed the small vessel about as she moved northward along the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Lookouts kept constant watch for British warships patrolling the shoreline as well as pirates. It was a particularly murderous outfit operating off the eastern seaboard known as the Bankers, that delighted in going after unprotected civilian ships. From Savannah to the Chesapeake, these bloodthirsty cutthroats were particularly feared, not only by the military, but especially civilian sea captains as well as civilian vessels. The biggest dread, though, was the British fleet. Rules of engagement at the time permitted British ships to destroy any civilian vessel they encountered suspected of being armed or operating as a privateer. To minimize suspicion in the event of a British stop, a pair of gun decks and other military armaments aboard the Patriot had been dismounted and hidden below deck. So that meant the little ship was not armed. completely vulnerable to pirates or even unfriendly Spanish or French gunboats. Well, somewhere between Georgetown and Nag's Head, the Patriot did encounter trouble. Exactly what the trouble was and where it happened remains a subject of intense debate among historian and maritime scholars. When the former privateer failed to arrive on schedule in New York, an intensive search and rescue operation was immediately launched. Investigators manning privately and federally registered vessels, brave British blockades, and roving bands of pirates to comb the entire eastern seaboard for signs of the missing ship. They even checked ports as far south as Nassau and as far north as Boston. But for some unexplained reason, they never bothered to follow up on reports about an unidentified schooner washing up on the lonely, storm-scarred beach at Nag's Head. Well, 6 months earlier, the U.S. had declared war on Great Britain. When pressed about the Patriot affair later, though, the London government emphatically denied any involvement. Well, that left open the possibility the Patriot had been overtaken by pirates who took what booty they could and murdered the passengers and crew. Of course, another possibility involved groups of what were called land pirates who patrolled the beaches on foot, swinging lanterns at night to try to draw ships into shallow water so they could be attacked. One pirate wrote a letter to the Charleston News and Courier that he had resorted to such a ruse to help seize the Patriot. Once drawn into the shallows, he claimed that he and his colleagues had swarmed aboard the small vessel, slaughtering everybody, passengers as well as crew members. He described finding the body of one woman, a woman who was obviously a noble woman or a lady of high birth. There are those that thought that might have been Theodosia Burr Alston. 20 years later, in 1833, an article in an Alabama newspaper reawakened interest in the Patriot. A man who resided in one of the interior counties of this state reported he made a deathbed confession linking him and several other companions to the capture of the Patriot. An article published in the Mobile Press Register, the unidentified man swore he had participated in the murder of all those on board and the scuttling of the vessel for the sake of her plate and effects. 15 years later, 1848, another confessed pirate told a similar deathbed story, adding that one of the passengers on board the captured vessel was a woman named Odessa Burr Alston. When given the choice of sharing a cabin with the pirate captain or walking the plank, she chose the plank. What does that say about the pirate captain? Well, in the following years, numerous other stories surfaced about the fate of the Patriot, some of them quite fanciful. One version said that a sea monster crawled aboard and devoured everybody and then slithered back into the sea. Another held the entire crew and all the passengers were being held hostage on a tiny island in the Bahamas. Well, in 1869, the portrait of a young woman resembling Theodosia entered the public debate. A woman claimed her husband found the painting in the wreck of a ship that had washed up on the shores of Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Known as the Nag's Head portrait, that painting now resides in the Lewis Walpole Library in Farmington, Connecticut. If that portrait is indeed Theodosia, and if it came from the Patriot, it would suggest a ship was either attacked off the North Carolina coast or washed up somewhere along the graveyard of the Atlantic, as that dangerous region along the Outer Bank was nicknamed because of its treacherous waters. Throughout the 1800s, old sailors and pirates made various other confessions about having witnessed Theodosia's demise, most of them dubious. In 1878, a man named Benjamin F. Burdick made such a confession as he lay dying. According to his story, he had been part of a raid on the Patriot and watched Theodosia walk to her death off the plank. According to him, with a Bible in her hand, she announced she was ready. Appeared as calm and composed as if she were at home, and not a tremor crept over her frame or a pallor overspread her features as she walked toward her fate. As she was taking the fatal step, she folded her hand over her bosom and raised her eyes to heaven. Fell off the plank and sank without a murmur. Well, numerous other theories about Theodosia's fate persist, as do reported sightings of her spirit. Some believe she still wanders her plantation home in South Carolina as a ghost, chased by spectral pirates longing to return to the city of her youth. Others say she haunts her father's home in the West Village in Manhattan, which today is a restaurant. I heard the stories when I was living in New York City. Despite the rumors surrounding her disappearance, for Aaron Burr, the fate of his beloved daughter was always clear. He said she's dead. She died in that miserable little pilot boat in which she left. If she was alive, all the prisons in the world couldn't have kept her from her father. As for Burr himself, he died in 1836, still mourning the mysterious loss of his daughter. He's buried in the President's Lot, Princeton Cemetery at Princeton, New Jersey. Now, there's one romantic theory that told how the Patriot washed up on the Texas Gulf Coast. Now, that was going in the wrong direction, but who am I to interfere with a theory? And in that story, Theodosia's rescued by Kurenkawa warrior. In exchange for the Indian's bravery, Theodosia supposedly gave him a gold locket. Years later, a group of white settlers in the area reported he saw a similar locket worn by an Indian with the inscription Theodosia on it. Well, when questioned about the locket, the Kurenkawa claimed that after a terrible storm, he found a ship wrecked at the mouth of the San Bernard River. Hearing a faint cry, he boarded the hulk and found a white woman, naked except for the gold locket, chained to a bulkhead by her ankle. The woman fainted when she saw the Indian, and he managed to get her free and carry her to shore. When she revived, she is supposed to have told him she was the daughter of a great chief of the white man and who was misunderstood by his people and had to leave his country. She gave him the locket and told him if he ever met white man, he was to show him the locket and tell him the story. And according to the legend, she died. Now, chained to the bulkhead would tend to say to me that the ship was captured by pirates and she was forced to submit to the pirate chief. Another myth traces its origin to Charles Guerrier's 1872 novel Fernando de Lemos, Truth and Fiction. In the novel, a pirate named Dominic Yu supposedly admitted having captured the Patriot after discovering it dismasted off Cape Hatteras following a storm. According to that account, Yu and his men murdered the crew and forced Theodosia to walk the plank. He said she stepped on it and descended into the sea with graceful composure as if she'd been alighting from a carriage. She sank, rose again, and an indescribable smile of angelic sweetness waved her hand to me as if she was saying farewell and thank you. A popular, though very improbable, local story in Alexandria, Virginia suggests that Theodosia may have been the so-called mysterious female stranger who died at Gadsby's Tavern October 14, 1816. She's buried in St. Paul's Cemetery with a gravestone inscription that begins, "To the memory of a female stranger whose mortal sufferings terminated on the 14th day of October, 1816, aged 23 years and 8 months." One of the most likely suggestions is that the Patriot fell victim to some military action relating to the ongoing War of 1812. Maybe the passenger ship was mistaken for a war vessel and sunk by an enemy ship, taking her secrets to the bottom of the Atlantic. Well, an assortment of stories involving a doctor who treated an elderly woman in the mid-19th century being paid with an oil painting later identified as a portrait of Theodosia. Was she killed or captured by pirates? Was her ship sunk by a British patrol vessel? Was it sunk by a storm? Was she forced to walk the plank? Did she manage to survive only to die before she could offer a clear explanation of events? Or did she change her name and live to a ripe old age? Well, we'll probably never know, but all that is certain is that she disappeared, and her disappearance ranks high in the folklore of early America. In all probability, the Patriot went down in a storm off Cape Hatteras. Logbooks from the blockading British fleet report a severe storm that began off the Carolina coast in the afternoon of January 2, 1813, and it raged into the next day. James Mitchie, an archaeologist from South Carolina who studied the course of the storm, concluded the Patriot was likely just north of Cape Hatteras when the storm was at its fiercest. If the ship managed to escape this battering, which continued until midnight, they would have then faced near hurricane-force winds in the early hours of Sunday. Given this knowledge, the Patriot probably sank about 6 p.m. Saturday, January 2nd, or certainly no later than 8 a.m. Sunday, January 3rd. It seems feasible that the schooner that drifted ashore at Nag Heads in January of 1813 was, in fact, the Patriot. The key clue was the portrait of the young woman found in one of the cabins, identified years later by family members as Theodosia Burr Austin. My only question is why, if I was going for a visit, would I take a portrait of myself with me? Seems a little odd. Now, this next story is about one of the mysteries of World War II. It involves a man named Lionel Crabb. He was a tall, dashing Royal Naval commander, said to be as handsome as he was heroic. An old-school cavalier with style, flair, distinction, and a broad, ready smile that caused ladies of all age to just swoon at his feet. His name was Lionel Crabb, but the press nicknamed him Buster after the movie star of the day, a nickname that stuck with him throughout his career. He was a diver. During World War II, he earned a reputation as the most courageous frogman in the Royal Navy. Always wore an Italian-made rubber suit and custom-crafted headgear. He struck a spunky pose on newsreels that showed him on daring missions around the world. He was the heartthrob of a generation, and when he vanished, one warm, muggy night in the murky waters off the coast of southern England, the British government grieved almost as much as did his legions of fans. Well, more than 60 years after his strange disappearance, the world still wonders what happened to Commander Crabb. He had once declared it would give him joy to die in the service of his country. The search for his whereabouts still continue, even though the British nation officially declared him dead long, long ago. His final day on Earth coincided with a visit to Portsmouth Harbor by three Soviet warships in 1956. Now, these weren't ordinary warships. According to British intelligence at the time, these three vessels represented the latest in Soviet naval technology. Fast, highly maneuverable vessels armed with sophisticated state-of-the-art radar systems and atomic missiles. And more importantly, on board the lead ship was the new Soviet premier, Nikita Khrushchev, the stocky, snaggle-toothed communist leader who happened to be embarking on his first official state visit to a Western nation since he took over from Joseph Stalin 3 years before. As the cameras rolled and the reporters crowded the piers for interviews and better views of the gleaming Soviet ships, a pair of frogmen, one wearing an expensive-looking Italian-made double rubber suit, slipped unseen into the dark, oil-stained waters of Portsmouth Harbor. Almost a year later, early on the morning of June 9, 1957, a young constable named Ronald Williams was on duty at Pillsley Island near Portsmouth when he was summoned to the harbor to investigate a body that had washed up on the shore during the night. Now, fishing bodies out of the harbor wasn't all unusual for Williams, who was a 10-year veteran of the police force. He'd pulled dozens of corpses, most of them drunken sailors who had fallen off ships and drowned. But this one was different. For one thing, the corpse was badly shriveled and was wearing a tailored Italian-made frogman suit. For another, both hands were missing. And as they pulled him out of the water, his head fell off and sank back into the oil-blackened water. And equally compelling was a series of rusted marks around the dead man's ankles. It looked as though the body had been chained underwater for a long period of time. Well, the mystery behind the headless frogman with the missing hands made front page news, as you might guess. Following an inquest, official theorized the dead diver was none other than Royal Navy Commander Lionel Buster Crabb, the legendary English underwater daredevil of World War II fame who'd been missing for a year. Commander's ex-wife and a pair of girlfriends were brought in to identify the body just to make sure. But almost immediately, rumors began that the dead man wasn't Commander Crabb at all. Some investigators suggested a fall guy had been planted in a diving suit similar to Crabb's favorite style, but Who would do such a thing and why? Well, to solve the mystery, it's important to understand the Frogman's disappearance occurred at the height of the Cold War, a time when Cloak & Dagger games were part of the action at hotspots around the world. In fact, many fans of Commander Crabbe insisted it was he who inspired the James Bond character in the popular Ian Fleming novels. 1 year earlier, on the morning of April 17, 1956, two of England's leading Cold Warriors booked into a posh hotel at the seaside town of Portsmouth. One was Commander Crabbe. The other was Bernard Sidney Smith, an agent with the British Special Intelligence Service, or SIS as it was known. Their stay coincided with the arrival of the three brand new Soviet warships that had the latest Cold War technology. Well, there are many who believe that Soviet divers were in the water at the same time as Crabbe approached the Soviet ships. Now, there was a lot of stories that began. There was a 74-year-old Russian who was 23 at the time of the Crabbe disappeared, who said he was ordered to go into the water and investigate suspicious activity around the lead ship. He said, "I saw the silhouette of a diver in a light frogman suit that was fiddling with something at the starboard next to the ship's ammunition stores." He said, "I swam closer and saw he was attaching a mine." Well, there are those that question whether Crabbe would have done something as drastic as attaching a mine. I mean, that would have been an act of war. The mystery and nail-biting intrigue over the commander's fate continues to generate intense interest. It's also spawned dozens of books. For its own part, the Royal Navy denied knowing about the incident or that it authorized Crabbe to spy on the Russian ship. Naval intelligence stated it thought Crabbe was working for MI6 when he went missing. One account of his death claimed he'd been captured and brainwashed by the Russians and that the body found was an imposter. Well, for all intents and purposes, Commander Lionel Buster Crabbe vanished when he slipped into the ocean that evening. And one government official claims the case is over. It ended the day he vanished from the face of the earth. Nothing left to the story but fairy tales. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. Tomorrow night, we're going to talk about Joseph Force Crater, the mysterious judge that vanished from New York City. Till tomorrow at 6 p.m. Mountain, 8 o'clock Eastern, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.